Okay, so let's learn.
Regards, Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. Where are we up to? Let's see. Das Tfila. Here we are. Okay, so last time we went through the second Hora'ah of Rav Avi Tzedek. V'yispal Avram Elokim. So he talked about the fact that Tfila somehow represents straightening us out. Right, Hisharat Ha'adam. Right, it's somehow straightening us out, and he quoted Psukim, but really it's a logical idea as well as that. Remember, this whole section here, he's trying to find the root of the word Tfila to figure out what do we do with it. But the reality is that, you know, what he's saying is not only because that's the root of the word, but because he feels that that's the key point, right? Hakirva shel ha'omed lifnei ha'melech. Right, the feeling of standing before the king, hargoshos vaakoras elokuso yisparach bedargas nochach pnei adam, to be willing to directly interface with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is something that straightens us out, is something that brings us to our senses. Now, of course, it is interesting that the Jewish people have not always been so excited about interfacing directly with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right, it's a very interesting comment here that Avodah Zarah, at the end of the day, is the desire to put something between me and God. And if that's the case, then Avodah Zarah can really take on many forms. It's based on the concept that we'll assume that people weren't dumb enough to actually think that a wooden pesel of some sort actually had divine power. That couldn't have been what was going on. People thought that somehow they needed this thing in order to be able to access God. The idea that there has to be some sort of symbol, there has to be some sort of thing, which really is at the heart of which sin, which famous sin really speaks to this? The idea of the golden calf, right? The sin of the golden calf was ultimately a question of the Jews believing that they needed some sort of an intermediary. That's certainly the way Rabbi Yehuda Halevi understands it in the Kuzari. That really all the Jews were looking for something formal to focus on. Or they were looking for, right? It's called an ego masecha. What is a masecha? Masecha means metal, but it also means a mask. It means a mask. It was the inability to really be vulnerable in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. To really put oneself in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu without any layers, without anything there, right? So if you think about it, that not only started at the Chet HaEgel, when does that really start? It really starts on Shavuos. It really starts at Matan Torah, when the Jewish people said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we don't want you to teach us. We want to have Moshe teach us. And even though their fear of God was admirable, that fear is a very important thing. Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want us to have to interface with him through another person, whether it's through a Rebbe, whether it's through Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Think about it. When they created what caused them to create the golden calf? What caused them to create the golden calf? The
absence of Moshe.
The absence of Moshe. What does one thing have to do with the other? So I guess the simple way we understood the story was that once Moshe Rabbeinu disappeared, then all the stuff that they learned about monotheism went out the window and they went back to their old ways. But they didn't really learn all they knew about monotheism from Moshe. They didn't really learn from Moshe. They stood at Sinai. That's what Shavuos is about, the fact that everybody stood at Sinai and heard God talking to them. So why should the disappearance of Moshe change the way that they believe about God? So a much simpler interpretation was that as so long as they thought they had Moshe, they didn't need a golden calf. Moshe was the golden calf, right? Moshe was the golden calf. Moshe was something that you could use to interface with God through an intermediary. And Moshe Rabbeinu was supposed to be that intermediary. The whole idea of the Amidah is that a person can interface directly with God, and that they need to. It's so interesting because in many ancient societies, the people were told that they couldn't interface directly with God. Now, of course, one of the reasons for that was because the people in charge needed to pull the wool over everybody else, Right? In ancient society, the idea that a person could speak directly to God was unheard of. Right? When we're called the Mamlechet Kohanim v'Goy Kadosh, that's the Chiddush. The Chiddush is that every person can have a relationship with the divine. That was a wild idea. There's a famous piece by Rabbi Sacks, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, about this, where he talks about the fact that in the Mesopotamia, the temples were built as ziggurats. Right? You thought that this would never come in handy. I really am not really sure why we learned so much about that stuff. But remember those pictures of the ziggurats with one layer and then another layer and another layer and another layer. So those temples represented the strata of society. And the fact that only the thing on top, very often the king, could interface directly with God. The people were at the bottom of the chain. Now, of course, again, much of this helped to continue the illusion that these divinities had power. Paro obviously knew he wasn't a god. He knew whatever it was, but if no one else was allowed to have conversations, then he could say whatever he wanted. So it is interesting that in ancient society, they would tell people they couldn't interface with God, and the Chiddush of Matan Torah was that the individual Jew could interface with God, but did he or she want to do that? That's what's so ironic. That's what's so ironic about Matan Torah. The Jews were given the ability to have a direct conversation with God, to stand before him. And their response was, we're not ready for that. We don't even want that. Now, partially, that could have been societal. They couldn't comprehend the idea that someone was going to have a significant relationship with God, that an individual was going to do that. But that's really the whole experience at Sinai. It's very Shavuos related, is this thing. At Shavuos, which we celebrate, actually lies, if you think about it, the roots of the Chet HaEgel in a certain sense, because we weren't willing to listen to God's voice, and then we felt we needed this intermediary. Intermediary was Moshe, intermediary was the golden calf. And what Rav Avi Tzedek points out for us is that we deprive ourselves of the opportunity of being honest with God, of having to actually show up and having to actually create that relationship with him. And that's chaval. Because merely putting ourselves in front of God, that alone helps to define who we are, helps us to straighten out. And that's why we have to, as I mentioned at the end of the shiur last time, that's why we have to do that 3 times a day. Basically, the times that we daven is a time of reorientation. And that makes sense, because the reality is, if tefillah was for God, then at a certain point, we'd get very annoying, right? If the purpose of tefillah was actually to say to God, can I have it? Can I have it? Can I have it? Can I have it? Right? It would be really chutzpahdik, especially like at a Mincha Ma'ariv, right? Can you imagine saying to God at Mincha Ma'ariv, you know, bring us the Mashiach, and like 5 minutes later, are we there yet? Is he here yet? Bring us the Mashiach again, Redav Meirov. So if the point of tefillah, forget about whether God needs our tefillahs, but if the point of tefillah is ultimately to get stuff, then at a certain point, we're just being annoying. We're just being children. I mean, we understand that the best way to get things is not to ask your parent for it 3 times a day, every single day, in exactly the same tone of voice. If he says no, if she says no, so at a certain point, an adult child has to say, well, maybe I need to rethink this. Maybe I need another strategy. Maybe I need to do better, but not just to keep asking and asking and asking. But the purpose of asking is to reorient ourselves, is to put ourselves right back in the right perspective, to actually have to stand up in front of God, to ask for the things that we want, to think about what's important to us, and to feel sometimes a little embarrassed in front of God, that this is what I'm worried about. This is what I'm thinking about. Right? The reality is, and we'll have other opportunities to talk about it, the text of Shemona Esrei serves that purpose on many levels. We know there didn't used to be such a text. There wasn't a text in the same way. Just standing up in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu was enough to get people to meditate about what was important. At a certain point, people really lost that ability. And what Chazal did was they gave us a text that helps us with that reorientation. We have to stand up in front of God. We have to make it a real experience. We have to be afraid. But also, we're given a text that pushes us in a certain direction. Pushes us in a certain direction. Think about it. The last half of the brachos of Shmoneh Esrei are spent on the Geula. Literally half. From bringing the exiles back together to restoration of justice, we would never have created the Shmoneh Esrei that way. We would never have gone, maybe at the end of the thing, you'll excuse me, we'll throw a proverbial Hail Mary, you'll excuse me, at the end for Mashiach. Okay, you know, I need this, I need that, and you know, I'm sure it's not going to happen now, but like if you bring Mashiach, it'd be very nice. That's the way we would say it. Half of the brachos are about national redemption? That completely challenges where our heads are at any given time. Would we really pray in the plural if it wasn't worded that way for us? Right? Would we really be thinking, would we really be pushed sort of out of our little comfort zone? So the text helps us. But at the end of the day, it's not just the text. It's really the standing before HaKadosh Baruch Hu that's supposed to have that kind of impact on us. And that he says, is the crime of Avodah Zarah. What's the Avodah Zarah today? Very often the Avodah Zarah is our unwillingness through prayer to let go a little bit. It's the cynicism. It's the unwillingness to close our eyes. It's the unwillingness to stay a few more minutes. It's the unwillingness to kind of really be there. That's the Avodah Zarah today. We create all these barriers so that we can be there, but not really fully let ourselves go. That's what Avodah Zarah is. That's that prevents us from having that encounter with HaKadosh Baruch. So that's just the continuation of last week. Let's read another piece today. So remember, he's speaking about how tefillah is din. Tefillah is din. And that doesn't make any sense, he wrote. Right? This is the conclusion of that whole section, that tefillah is din, but tefillah is not supposed to be din. Tefillah is supposed to be asking for rachamim. So what does that mean, that tefillah is din? Why would we say that? So remember, the first thing he said was that even though the goal is rachamim, but by putting ourselves up in a vulnerable situation, so that alone is like standing up for judgment before it even has an impact on us. Just being willing to stand up that way, that's we're naturally exposing ourselves to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the din. The second interpretation was that it's actually a straightening out of our priorities. It's sort of almost what happens to us, which is what I'll go into, you know, in the next piece after this. It's not simply the act of standing in front of him, but it's the effect of standing in front of him and how that straightens it out. Now he takes it in one more direction. One more way that tefillah is like din. So he goes back to what we learned about last week. Vatoma Rachel naftule Elokim niftalti imachosi. Did everybody see this? It's up on the screen. Okay. Vatoma Rachel naftule Elokim niftalti imachosi gam yacholti. Vatikrashimo naftali. Right. He already mentioned this in the last section, that one of the roots of the word tefillah seems to come from the naming of Naphtali. The same root, right? The same root. There seems to be this similar root. Now, of course, it's backwards, Petel and Tefel, but he's assuming that it is of a similar root, right? And then he quotes the full quote from the Unklus. The Amart Rachel, Kabil Ba'usi, my prayer has been accepted. Kibil Ba'usi Hashem. God has accepted my prayer. Be'ischananusi betzlusi chamidit. A lot of discussion about what that word chamidit. Be'ischananusi, when I pleaded with a prayer that was, they say it probably was from heartfelt or beloved. De'yavili vlad ka'achati, that I should have a child just like my sister. Af isyavli, and you gave it to me. That's what Unkla says. So again, Unkla said that when she says naftulei elokim niftalti, it means that I prayed. I prayed for this child so I could have a child. This was the first child that Rachel has through her handmaiden. So I prayed that I should be able to have this child. And Rashi says, "Vani mefarsh loshon ikesh ufataltol nekashti veftzarti betziras harbiv naftulu makom." I straightened myself. I twisted myself, and then eventually I straightened myself. So he says like this: "Kedei latzeit mishlitas ma'areches hateva v'hamazel." He says, in order to leave the rule of, in order to leave the I'm trying to think of the right word. The world runs in different ways. Typically, the world runs according to something that we would say is teva and mazel. Now, the word mazel is probably the least understood word in the Hebrew language. We say to people, mazel tov, best of luck. Mazel, I don't know exactly how we got to this. Mazel is the opposite of luck. Mazal is from the word nizol, which means to drip down. Mazal means fate. That which is fated for us that comes from the heavens. So really, when you're saying mazal tov, you're saying good fate. If it's your fate, why do we have to wish it for you? I don't know. But mazal tov is very misunderstood. So most of us live in the ma'arechet of teva and mazal. For some reason, God created the world that the same thing is supposed to happen every day. There's such a thing as nature. There's such a thing as mazal, as fate. In other words, our lives are pretty much programmed, and they can go on autopilot. We want to leave that autopilot. Kedei levat el hagzeiro v'likro agzar hadin, in order to uproot the plan that's before me, the things that are supposed to happen to me, what naturally would be, tzarich lehitakesh betfila u'leharbot hefzer. We have to be very, very strident in our tefillah, and we have to beg. In other words, prayer is asking God to change the natural course of events. It's not as if anything could happen tomorrow, and this might happen, that might happen. Of course, God is not bound by anything, but there is a plan. There is a teva. There is a nature. All things being equal, this is what's going to happen. In other words, the burden of proof is on the mitpalel. And that's why if a person prays and wants to succeed, they have to work hard at it. It's not just a passing thing you say to God, because the burden of proof, the given, right, the status quo is going to continue unless you're able to overturn it. Uketfilas Moshe Rabbeinu, Vayechal Moshe et Pnei Hashem, Kadosh Baruch Hu, it says, Vayechal Moshe, Amar Rebbe Elazar Melamed, She'amad Moshe betfilah lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ad Shehecheluhu. What does Rashi says? What is Hechilu Hifzer Bo? Moshe Rabbeinu, when he pleaded HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he just was begging him and just annoying him. Because for prayer to work, it takes a little bit of a miracle. If a miracle is a change in nature, that's really what we're asking for. Tfila zu hapoelet shinoi hagzeira mishula lecherev. This tefillah, which is causing an overturning of a gzeira, and the gzeira here is not necessarily in a bad sense, but it means God actually has a plan for tomorrow for you and I. When we daven Ma'ariv, we're trying to say, no, I'd like you to take a different approach. And it's called a sword. This kind of thing that will change it is called a sword. As it says, Asher lakachtem yad ha'amori b'charbi u'b'kashti. Yaakov Avinu on his deathbed tells Yosef, I'm going to give you one city on top of all that your brothers have. I'm going to give you an extra portion. And that is the city of Shechem. That's where Yosef is buried. Not the best neighborhood right now, but that's where Yosef is buried, right? And Yaakov says, this is the city that I took from the residents, from the Canaanites, from the Amorites, with my sword and my bow. Sounds like Yaakov Avinu fought to liberate the city of Shechem, except we have no indication that that's true. In fact, who fought in Shechem? Shimon and Levi. And when they got back to their father, Yaakov scolded them and said, why would you do this? Why would you pick up a weapon? So it seems a little disingenuous for Yaakov Avinu at the end of his life to say to Yosef, I'm giving you the city of Shechem, which I took with my sword and my bow. So Targum Unkelos there says, Bitzlusi ubevausi. He wasn't pretending that he went to war. He said he took it with his prayers. When he was praying for his children, he was praying for the safety of the family. The prayers of Yaakov Avinu were like weapons. Like weapons. Kara unkelos hatfila shel hatzadik cherev, dehi kora'as elyonim v'tachtonim. It cuts through. It has to break through. It has to be a sword. V'hatchina keshet mimneisha humit kashe ma'od b'tfilato. And even the word keshet, a bow, is from the word kashe, something very, very difficult. You have to reach deeply. You have to reach deeply in order to be able to pull back. Tefillah is something that for it to work takes din. You have to go to war. You have to go to court. You basically have to go to court and say to God, I know you had this plan, but I'm putting a cease and desist order on your world. I'm going to tell you, that's it. You cannot function anymore. V'tzarech lehitameitzu liskashos kebetfiloso bekashti, ukefishin emar al tfiloso shel Moshe v'yachal Moshe. Right? Tanya Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol Omer Malamed She'amad Moshe B'tfilu Lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ad She'achazoso Achilu. Ma Achilu Omer Rabbi Elozer Eish Shalatzamos. The Gemara continues in Brachos and says he got a fever. He had some sort of feverish condition. He got so into his prayer that he got into feverish condition. Again, we're not all expected to be Moshe Rabbeinu, but the question is, why would Moshe Rabbeinu have to get to such a place? Because Moshe Rabbeinu is trying to overturn a gzeira that Hashem made. Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu, you're not supposed to go into the land. Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to overturn that. Moshe Rabbeinu understood what he was up against. What he was up against. It's much harder to overturn the status quo. And that's what he was ultimately asking. He was asking God, don't allow things to go by nature. Do things, because of my tefillah, change the world that we live in. Da'as l'navon nakel. This is the second time I use that phrase. It is easy for a wise person to understand this. Okay, so in other words, it's not so easy to understand. But if you're a wise person, you'll understand this. She'inyan zeh nachon l'gabi kol tefillah. This is true of every tefillah. Ba'asher inyan zeh hu mehora'at shema. This is part of the word tefillah, is to twist yourself. Eventually you'll unwind yourself, as we said, but to beg. Umavur huadavar, lafima shehivenu bishem haramban, kitfila inyana shinui marechet ateva pa'ulat neis. Like we said earlier when we started this, that every single tefillah is ultimately asking God for a miracle. Now you'll ask me, isn't there some Mishnah in Brachos that says you're not allowed to ask for a miracle? There is such a Mishnah in Brachos. If you come and you see a fire in the town, the Mishnah says, you're not allowed to say, God, don't let that be in my home. Because either it is or it isn't. And you're not supposed to say to God, once a woman is pregnant, we're not supposed to pray that it be a boy or a girl, because Chazal understood that it was already a boy or a girl at that point. So what does the Ramban mean? Every prayer is praying for a change in nature, a miracle. So am I allowed to pray for miracles, or am I not allowed to pray for miracles? So the answer is simple. Why are we not allowed to pray for miracles? Why can't I pray that an open miracle should happen? Because God does not like to do open miracles. Open miracles play with our faith. What's the best case scenario here in terms of some open miracle? What are you praying for? So I come into the city and I say, don't let it be my house. And it is your house. So either your tefillah is going to go unanswered and you'll be mad at God, or miraculously, everyone's going to say the most unbelievable thing happened. The fire went out in your house and it suddenly caught fire next door. You'll say, wow, there's no other way to explain that other than a miracle. Your house was completely raging in fire, and in a moment it went out, and then it started down the block. That's an open miracle. When we see open miracles, our sense of Bechira Chafshis, our sense of free choice, is swayed with. That's why throughout Tanakh, God does open miracles only on very specific occasions. Doesn't like to do very open miracles. There are moments in time where we need that. And what we're told is not to pray for a miracle like that. But the Ramban says, every little thing is also a miracle. Every little thing is also a miracle. We shouldn't pray that God change nature in a way that there's no other way to explain it. Absolute, there's no way to explain what happened other than the fact that God did a miracle. But if we define a miracle as God stepping in and helping me out, well, that hopefully happens every day in small ways, certainly if I'm praying. So it's kind of a catch-22. On the one hand, I'm not supposed to pray for open miracles. I'm not supposed to pray that the sky open up, that the sun stands still. Those are not things of our prayers. There's no reason for us to believe that God is desirous of doing that, or that we're at a time where that's necessary, or that our prayers are going to accomplish that. Stay away from that. But remember that any little thing, God, could you help me out? I have an important business meeting today. So what I'm effectively saying to God is, according to nature, the business meeting is going to go however it's going to go. And I'm asking you to step in and to make it go better than that. I want you to change it. I want you to change the direction. God's much more willing to do that, because the reality is, when the meeting goes well, the likelihood is that I'll say, oh, I did a really good job presenting at the meeting. That doesn't usually change our Bechira Chafshis too much, because often we ignore it. But ultimately, that's what we're praying for. And that's, he said, what the word tefillah means. Tefillah, it's in the nature of tefillah to have to really daven. You have to remember that when we're praying, the odds are against us. The odds are against us. The most likely thing that's going to happen tomorrow, we have to feel like, the most likely thing that's going to happen tomorrow is the world's just going to take its normal, natural course. We believe that we can change that. But if we're going to change that, even in a tiny way, it requires a tremendous amount of effort and a tremendous amount of kavanah. I know it's a difficult concept today as well, as we had 2 weeks ago when we talked about these ideas. Okay, that's the end of the first section. Oop, you see, I can't scroll down anymore. That's it. Yitzhak Hashem will try next week to go into his next section, where he looks at the word hitpalel, which, of course, from our painful days trying to learn Hebrew grammar, is when I do something to myself, right? There's a type of grammar, there's a verb form called hitpael. When I hitpael, I do something to myself. I'm mitlabesh, I dress myself. So it's not only that I'm setting myself up for judgment, in some way, I'm really judging myself during the Shmoneh Esrei. That's what he's going to talk about next time. We'll have to figure out how that process goes. Okay, I'm going to sign off for tonight. Wish everybody a very, very good Yom Tov, and Mitzvah Shem, we'll see you next Monday.
Thank you.
You're welcome.